Hi, Bunch. I'm Jerry Jones, and I'm an alcoholic. Been sober since January the 1st of 1973, for which I'm very grateful. Very grateful that some of you showed up tonight. I generally have got the group culled down pretty good by the time I've talked three times, but you're hanging in there. Either that or we got a lot coming in. Tonight we're going to talk about four steps. We're going to talk about the sixth, seventh, eighth, and ninth step. To this point, in my analysis of the steps, essentially we've recognized we have a problem in our lives. It has something to do with alcohol. Some of you said may not know whether it's alcohol or something else, but it has something to do with a chemical. And if you've looked at it with any degree of care at all, you come to recognize without any reservation that it's something you can't do anything about yourself. Most of us recognize it as an incurable chronic disease that continues to get worse and never gets better. And we lack the power to do anything about it, and all human beings, there is no human power that can deal with it. But we recognize that something's going on in Alcoholics Anonymous. Something in here is working. And last week we talked about making a commitment. Now that's a bad word for a lot of alcoholics. We don't like to commit things too much. We want to keep our options open. You know, we want to keep floating along here, and you know, there's no reason to burn any bridges and this sort of thing. But this is the kind of a commitment that we can live with. This is a decision to go a different direction. We're not going to be able to decide and do God's will because we don't know what it is. We're not going to be able to turn our will and our lives over to the care of this power right here at this point because we don't know how to do that. We don't know what to do with our lives. And they're left to us to live, aren't they? So what we do at this point in our steps is to make a decision and to recognize what we've been doing in the past. It tells us we've got to find out that self-centeredness and selfishness cannot serve as a reasonable basis for life. It just won't work. And we begin to look at ourselves. We begin to look at the problem, and the problem is me. And we find this thing called self-centeredness lots of different ways. There's no telling how many different ways it could be described by people in this group. Some of us are egomaniacs in the sense that we feel like we're better than most folks. Look down our nose upon people. Critical, sarcastic, all of those things. People don't live up to our expectations. That's one kind. There are other kinds. There's the kind that thinks they are the lowest of the low. I'll never forget one night I was in a meeting with a little girl, and she was very shy. And I hadn't been sober very long, and she began to tell something about what was going on in her life. And as the group would, you know, we gave her, if there were 26 people there, we gave her 26 solutions to her problem. Just everybody had a different one, you know. And at the end of that meeting, she sat in her chair when everybody else got up to leave, and she was crying. And I don't know why, but I walked over to her and I said, "What's wrong?" She said, "I am so unworthy that you wonderful people would take your time to talk to me about a life as rotten as mine." Now, you see, that's just as self-centered as the person who really thinks they've got it all together and demands that you and I do what they want us to do. There's something in the mind of a self-centered person that puts themselves at the center of every situation. You're either better than it or worse than it. You're dictating the way it ought to be. We see. Only see, hear, smell, taste those things that are kind of important to us. And we see the things in life that we think affect us. We take it personally. 1974, we had a big shortage of gasoline. I took that personally. The Arabs were after me. I just couldn't find anything. It drove me crazy. What was I going to do with that gasoline for my car? Finally, I made myself ride the damn bus to work for a while to convince myself I could make a living without a car full of gas. Now, if it's off the buses, I don't know. I might have gone off the deep end. There's no telling. But see, I took all that personally, and it got to be an insurmountable. There was, you might have had a little problem with gas, but I had a real problem with gas. Mine was a big problem with gas, not like yours. Yours, you can get along with it. If you get me to work, I can take care of everybody just about. But that was the way I saw it. Now, when you recognize that you're living a self-centered, ego-centered, selfish, taking things personally kind of life, then they tell us to look and examine and find out. We got to study ourselves. We got to see how specifically that works in our life. We got to find the causes and conditions of what's blocking us from what? The power that allows us to live comfortably and well in life. The power that we're trying to make a decision to turn our will and our lives over the care of. And our book tells us, and our program teaches us, that if we can get this self-centeredness out of the way, then it's like nature abhors a vacuum. If we get self out of the way, this God-centered life will come into our lives. And so we began to look at that, and we examine these attributes called self-centeredness: resentment, fear, and our sex lives. That's the general area of our inquiry. If you read the 12 and 12, you'll know you looked at the seven deadly sins. But what we're basically looking for is common forms of self-centeredness and what they did to us in our life. It's very important that we realize what self-centeredness has done to us. That it's kept us unhappy. That we've had no chance of success in life as long as we're operating with that in mind. That we can't do anything about it by ourselves. Our book also tells us that in several places in the fifth chapter, that we can't do much about self-centeredness on our own power. And it's just exactly like whiskey. If you think you've got power over whiskey, exercise some. If you think you've got power over self-centeredness, try to get rid of it. You'll, if you're like me, only find that the time you spend working on your self-centeredness makes you more self-centered. And you just kind of auger in, you know. And that's a bad place to be augured in. You have to tell somebody about yourself. You got to take a chance. You got to go for it. It requires some courage for some reason that I'll never really understand. Why should it be so hard for me to be me? Unless I am deeply convinced that I'm not good enough. And most of us think we're not good enough. We've been fighting a disease over which we had no power for a long time and getting the bejeebies kicked out of us. We've created all kinds of problems in the lives of other people. We're walking around with a load of guilt, and we're trying to raise our self-esteem. And if we go back to our inventory and start going through that inventory for the purpose of kicking ourselves around, it's dead wrong. We're going to go back and look and see where we've made our mistakes and try to learn something about them. Try to learn, how was I involved in this deal? Not just blame them. Most of us never get any further than blaming somebody. Who? Oh, damn near everybody. Our parents, our employers, our wives, our children. Just somebody that has interfered with us in some way, and we've done our best, and it's got to be their fault. So we blow them off. And we shift around and we go find somebody else to try to do some business with, and we wind up, we're mad at them, it's their fault, and we continue to go through life. Or we decide we're totally worthless, like the little lady I was telling you about. Now, all forms of self-centeredness have some things in common. One, your experience with self-centeredness is your own. I can't find it. I can't even tell you what it is. If anybody's going to ever see it and find it, it's going to have to be you. You can keep it as long as you want to. No one can take it away from you. Do not worry about it for a minute. I can sit down in that chair right there, spend a few minutes thinking about what they did to me, remember some of those old events, and let my mind run, and I'll get just as mad as I did the day when it first happened. So it's mine. It's mine to hang on to. They're all very much the same. As a matter of fact, mine have a tendency to shift from one to the other. Let me give you an example. I've had a bad day at work. I never even got to my office today. I started trying real early, and I had to stop at a court on the way there, and I got caught in a hearing, and I've been there all day long. And I feel a little bit sorry for myself because I've been there all day. I didn't even get to get out of my lawyer suit before I got here tonight, you see. So I leave there and I'm feeling a little bit self-centered. I'm feeling a little sorry for myself, a little self-pity. I'm not appreciated. Nobody knows the kind of problems I have. So I get on the expressway. Somebody cuts in front of me. They don't appreciate what a bad day I've had. They don't give a damn what kind of bad day I've had. But they're doing it to me, so I switch from self-pity to anger. I try to punish them on the way home probably, but maybe they got away from me and I never got to honk at them or run them off the road or anything. Maybe flashed them a bird and they didn't even have the common courtesy to look in the rear vision mirror, you know. So I walk in to my house, kick the dog, who didn't know there was anything wrong. My wife comes up to give me a hello kiss and I say, "What the hell are you doing, you know, trying to mess up my suit?" She didn't know what's wrong. She backs up and said, "What's wrong with you?" And I said, "What's wrong with me? What's wrong with me? There's not a damn thing wrong with me. There's something wrong with you. What have I done? What have you done? Did you wash the clothes today?" "No. No, I don't wash clothes on Monday. You ought to. You know I'm going to need fresh shirts this week. I looked 2 weeks ago and there wasn't a shirt in there, the one I wanted. And I'm off on this deal, you see. I'm blaming her. I'm getting mad at whoever's handy and whoever it's safe to get mad at." Then I walk off to the bedroom, storm off, and I suddenly recognize, you know, you shouldn't be acting like this. You shouldn't be acting like this. You're being a little bit unreasonable. You're being a whole lot unreasonable. You know, if you keep treating that woman like that, she's going to divorce you. If she divorces you, she'll get half of every damn thing you own. At least. Now fear is upon me. Fear is just raging around, and I know it's going to happen to me. And now I'm feeling sorry for myself again because here I work so damn hard, and my wife's going to take half of everything I own and throw me on the street. It's gone full cycle. And I'm the only player in this drama. Me and the dogs I kick. And the people I honk at. And nobody's done anything to me, but it's just moved around. I'm unhappy. And I was unhappy a lot. I had this unresolved discontent. Did you ever have that? Where you just know something's wrong? What's wrong? I don't know. Everything is wrong. You can't please me. They finally told my wife in Al-Anon if she was throwing rose petals at my feet, they'd be the wrong color. And she believed them, and she quit throwing them at my feet, I'll guarantee you. But I needed that. I needed to come in touch with reality. And I needed to appreciate what these things were doing in my life. And to know that I had to play a part in finding them. I had to play a part in seeing what they had done to my life. I had to tell somebody about them. And I had to become entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character. You know, entirely ready is a lot of ready. That's a whole lot already. It's very difficult for me to explain that to you, but I got a joke that I'm obsessed with this joke. I tell it every time I do the steps. And I'm going to tell it again right now. It's about this guy about my age who had an office, had a bunch of people working there. And he had one lady that was working there that he really did like. She was a really nice looking lady. He had told her on many occasions that he would like to improve the relationship which they had. And as the Bible would say, of him she would have none. Until this day, it was his birthday and he walked in and she walked up to him and pinned a little flower on his lapel and gave him a little kiss and said, "Happy birthday, boss." And he said, "Well, thank you, thank you." And she said, "You know, I've been thinking. And really, I know you wanted to
have a closer relationship with me than I have permitted. Is that right? And he said, yes. And she said, would you like to improve our relationship? And he was ready. And he said, yes. And she said, if you'll come to my apartment this afternoon at 5:30, we'll start improving our relationship. He said, what time do you have now? And she told him, she said, I don't want you there early now, nor late, just be there. He said, I'll be there at 5:30. When the second hand got to the top at 5:30, he pushed the button. She came to the door, she invited him in, she mixed him a drink, she took his coat, she sat him down on the couch, she sat beside him, she began to talk to him, and she said, would you mind if I slipped into something a little more comfortable? He said, oh, no, no, please do. He was ready for her to do that. Now, when she went into the bedroom to slip in something a little more comfortable, he began to get entirely ready. He noticed his tie was too tight, so he just took it off. His shoes got to cramping his feet, and he took them off. Finally, he decided that he would just take off his shirt. Then he decided he would just take off his trousers. He wasn't going to need them long anyway. And he called out in the bedroom and he said, are you ready? And she said, in a minute. In a minute. And he got more and more ready. Finally, he was standing there totally naked. And he called out and he said, are you ready now? And she said, come on in. Now, he went through the bedroom door in a state of entirely ready. Entirely ready. And his entire office staff said, surprise, happy birthday to you, happy birthday to you. And then, you see, he knew humility, like we're talking about in the seventh step, which is why I tell this joke. You don't ever get entirely ready until you really appreciate what your self-centeredness has done to you and what has happened to you. But even that's probably not enough. Probably you need something more. After you've done your fifth step, you go home and you ask yourself if you've done a good job on your fourth and fifth step. Have you been thorough? And then it gives you a little exercise to go through in two paragraphs, which are called the seventh step prayer. And that prayer essentially says you're asking God to remove from you those defects of character which what? Cause me trouble? No. Which stand in the way of my usefulness to God and my fellow man. That's essentially what you're going to try to do in the seventh step. Now, this is really important. This is a shift in our program. Because from this point on, we don't work on our problem, my problem, anymore. Here we shift and we become concerned with how my character defects are interfering with the commitment I made back there in the third step. I'm going to try to live my life so that I can be of maximum service to God and my fellow man. And if you think about these defects of character we have, it's easy to see how they interfere with our relationship with our fellow man. We got here with lousy relationships, almost without exception. We got here with bruised feelings all around us. We had let anger and guilt and fear dominate our lives so that we simply were not much use to us, to anybody, even ourselves. And here we are at the sixth step, and we're beginning to want to become a part of the solution. I don't even remember the night this happened to me, but I had a wonderful thing happen to me in my life one night. I was driving home from a meeting. I was in probably the first 6 months of my sobriety. I had done my fourth step a little bit before that, I remember. And I was driving home after a meeting, and I started singing a song. I have no earthly idea when I had last sung a song, but it had been a long time. I looked around to see if anybody noticed me. It was so strange. And I recognized something is happening to me. Something is happening to me. I'm singing a song for no reason. And then I began to recognize that I don't really go to meetings anymore because I need a meeting. Oh, there were days that I did, of course. But my motivation had changed. Do you know why I was going to meetings? I liked what was going on there. I liked being a part of what I could see happening. I was concerned about some guy getting a job, whether somebody stayed sober that day, what happened at the DWI hearing. I had got caught up in the problems that I saw my friends having, and I'd got to feel like I was a part of a solution. I got excited about what was going on in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had found a purpose in life. I didn't go there because I was going to drink if I didn't go to meetings. I went there because I could see something happening that was just exciting and fun to me. They say you have to go to meetings until you want to go, and it's a lot easier after that. And I had begun to want to go to meetings. And that's the pivotal point in our program. If we can shift out of this self-centered life that we lead, where we go to meetings just because I've got to have a meeting to stay sober, I've got to work on my anger, I've got to work on my fear, I've got to work on my, me. If we can get into you, the drunk, the new drunk, the fellow alcoholic, if we can just be a good friend, if we can begin to do 12-step work, then we shift from a self-centered life to a God-centered life, to be of maximum service to God and my fellow man. Now, I don't know that this was, I don't think this happened to me on a single night. I doubt it happens to anybody on a single night. I didn't become humble. I'm sure I've had periods of being humble. Not humility in the sense of humiliation. That's what I was thinking about when I first read this step. I seriously thought about, was I going to have to quit being a trial lawyer because of being humble? I could just see myself standing down there in front of the judge, scuffing my shoes and saying, gosh, judge, I sure do wish you'd help my client, you know. I ain't nothing. And we ain't nothing, but we sure could use a little help. I couldn't figure how anybody would pay me to do that, and I still haven't figured out why they'd pay me to do that. And don't think that's got anything to do with it. Adam, he came from humble origin. That meant I was poor. Hell, I was poor. Didn't want any more poor. Didn't want any daily bread. I was looking for steak. You know, I had a lot of problems with this kind of stuff, and I had to come to grips with what I was really dealing with here. But as I found out who I was, as I began to recognize that I'm just a human being, I got lots of faults. I got lots of things going on in my life over which I have no power. And that includes what? My alcoholism, for one. But maybe even more important than that, it includes my character defects. I can't do any better than that. If I could do any better than that, I wouldn't have to ask God in the seventh step to remove them, would I? So, I didn't know that. I hadn't found this power at that point in my life. So I can't feel too bad about myself, can I? And as I've gone along here, I've come to understand that you, and you, and you, and you, had the same kind of problem. You can't do much about your character defects either. All you can do is find them, recognize and appreciate what they are, what they're doing to your life, tell somebody about them, become entirely ready to get them out of the way, to be a part of the solution to life, to be of service to God and my fellow man. And then, humbly, with all humility, with a feeling that I'm a person who's powerless, I've had some things going on in my life that I really don't like, I'd like to change. I'd like to be the kind of me that I can be with your help. A person that knows who God is and who his fellow man is and that we're all equal. And when we say Our Father in the Lord's Prayer, God ain't got no grandkids. We're all dead even in the spiritual world. A person who can believe that no matter what we've said before, if what we think or feel means anything at all, it means that every person, no matter what his race, color, or creed, can form a meaningful relationship with his Creator if he has the willingness and the honesty to try. Like it says, I believe, on page 29 of our book. And with those kind of things in mind, and headed in a new direction in life, where I'm going to try to turn my will and my life over to the care of this power, to get rid of those things as nearly as I can that are standing in my way of my usefulness to God and my fellow man. And I say that prayer, I think I'm exactly in the right place to say it. And then, when I've done that, I begin to take action with respect to other people. And the first place I take action is in the eighth step. The eighth step says that we made a list of persons that we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. I wouldn't go to meetings like this in the beginning. I didn't want to hear a lot about this kind of stuff. I went to hear my wife talk one time, an Al-Anon talk. I didn't like it a bit. Made me very uncomfortable to hear her talk about how she reacted to my being drunk and how my kids, and she had lots of conversations about how they might sober me up and wondering whether it would be a good idea to pour out the whiskey and all of these kind of things that went on. That just made me very uncomfortable. Matter of fact, I didn't like to hear any Al-Anon's talk. I just made me uncomfortable, and so I didn't go hear them talk unless I just was tricked into it. See, I'd been telling myself some things, and I told them too, when they were trying to get me to clean up my life, to see what I was doing, to recognize how I was hurting them. They weren't suffering in silence, I'll damn sure tell you that. They were telling me a lot of times that I was doing something wrong. They told me, lots of people told me. But what was my reaction to that? My reaction to that was, I ain't hurting nobody but me if I'm hurting anybody at all. And when you talk to me about making amends to people, well, what about them? What about what they did to me, by God? Who's going to make amends to me if I'm cleaning up am I going to be the only guy in the town that cleans up his act? Is that fair? Should I go around with my head down and scuffing my shoes and saying, God, I'm sorry I'm such a bad guy, when they would just run over me again? Well, no, I would if they would. But you notice that's not in the step. Unfortunately, that's not in the step. Seems to be no quantitative, nothing fair about this damn step that I can see. It's one way as you can get. Cuts no exceptions at all. Now, you get over to the ninth step and you might find an exception of some kind, but the eighth step gives you no slack. It says you got to make a list of the people you've harmed. Oh, you're talking about hitting them with my fist. No. Yes, hitting them with your fist, but every other kind of harm that you can do to them as well. My God, how many people would that be? Are you talking about the people that I ran off the road when they got in my lane? Those people? How about the telephone operators that I called all sorts of good names because they messed up my call? Yep, them too. And you start going through the list and it's endless. It's endless. It's too big. It's impossible to do this thing, isn't it? So why should we start doing something if we can't do it right? I had more justification and rationalization about not doing the eighth step than I did about the fourth step. I had a terrible problem with a thing called forgiveness. That's really where a lot of it turns on. Forgiveness. Forgive us as we forgive those who trespass against us. As we forgive those. If I'm going to get forgiven, that prayer says I need to do something myself. And I had some problems seeing how that worked. I had some problems seeing where I was at fault at all in this whole scheme of things. And I didn't want to give up some of this stuff. I had some bad breaks happen to me that might have been God's fault. He could have made me a little better looking. He could have given me a little more money. You know, and I had some feelings about my place in life. It didn't seem quite fair to me that I should have to hump and scratch when Nelson Rockefeller had it all sacked up for him the day he got here. And so I had some grudges against God. And that's kind of a useless task, I'll tell you, because I figure he's going to outlast you one way or the other. So I had to begin to look at some of this stuff a little bit to see what was going on with me. Let me give you some specific examples. I was a young lawyer in this law firm, and there was this guy who was quite a bit older than I was, really a crackerjack lawyer. And I got to be sort of his number one assistant. I carried his briefcase. I did his briefing. I wrote letters for him. I read his mail. I sent out his bills. I conferred with him. I talked to him. I worked for him almost all the time. I really did admire this man. I wanted to make a good impression on him. I wanted to be a good lawyer, as good a lawyer as he was. And I watched how he practiced law, and I tried my best to be as good as he was. And this wasn't any week I did this. I did this for years. For years. And then one day, he came in my office and said, "Jerry," he said, "I'd like for you to go downstairs and get a cup of coffee with me." And I said, "Well, we don't need to do that. They got a coffee pot right down the hall." He said, "No, I want to talk to you." So I recognized something a little heavy is coming down here. And we went downstairs, and he said, "Jerry, I want you to know, I haven't announced this to anybody in the firm yet, but I want to tell you something that's going to happen." He said, "Several of the partners of this law firm and I are going to leave and form our own law firm, a new law firm. And we're asking several of the young lawyers to go with us." And I waited, because I knew I was going to be invited. And he didn't say a damn thing about me being invited to go. In fact, he made it clear that he didn't expect that I was going at all, because he said, "When we leave, I'm confident that you will make partner in this law firm." And I had been wronged. I didn't want to go with them, because there were a couple of those guys that he had said were going to go with that new firm that I didn't like at all. But I deserved to be asked. I did, by God. I deserved to be asked. I had worked too many nights and too many weekends and too many days trying to please this guy and make his life. He had told me what a great lawyer I was. And I got mad at him like you ain't ever been mad at anybody in your life. Well, maybe you have. You're drunks, so you probably can match me on this. But I really did get mad at him. After he left our firm, the clients that we represented, every one of them that I worked for hired me and hired him also. So I had to spend 2 years with this guy, him and another law firm and me and this one, and I hated being with him every day I was there. And when I finally got the last one of those cases closed out, there was no question in my mind I was never going to do anything with that guy again in my life. And when I read about resentments and thought about that a little bit, I had no trouble at all identifying that I had a resentment against Morris. I really had a beaut. So I didn't take the fourth step for a while, because I could read on ahead. They're talking about me going and making some amends. I ain't going to make no amends to this guy. I ain't done a damn thing wrong. I ain't going to do it. I'm kind of like the guy I heard talk one time. He said he carried a shovel in the back of his car all the time because he's going to kill this guy and he had to have something to bury him with. You know, I was not cutting any slack here. I spent hours sitting in a chair thinking about what I was going to do to this guy. One day I was going to get a case against him, and I was going to make him look like Ned in The First Reader. I was going to beat him every way in the world. I spent hours thinking about these things and how he would come to me and beg for mercy, and I'd say, "No, no way, Jose." Crazy thoughts, wild thoughts. And finally I read the four-step prayer.
It says that I've got to recognize that other people can make mistakes too. By then, in my program, I began to recognize that I had made some mistakes. And so I began to pray for forgiveness for this man. It worked pretty good, because over a year or so, I got to where I could speak to him, didn't cross the street to avoid him, just really got in reasonably good shape this way. Thought I had solved this problem, thought I had worked the steps on this problem. Never occurred to me one time that I'm going to make amends to this guy. Well, I just really hadn't done that much to him. It's not anything like he'd done to me. Then one night I was in Lubbock, and I saw a restaurant that I hadn't thought about in a long time. And I remembered the last time I'd been in that restaurant, I'd been with Morris and a man who represented the Murchison interest in Dallas. Morris at that time was president of the State Bar of Texas. This other man was a senior lawyer in another law firm that we were working for. And we went in there after we had been out for the evening for a while. We'd gone to our motel, had a few drinks. We'd been in trial most of the day. The lawyers on the other side invited us out to have a drink or two and talk about settlement. We didn't talk about settlement. We rattled sabers and all this kind of stuff and drank several more drinks. And by now, I'm not feeling a lot of pain. And then a wonderful thing happened to my life. The music got quiet. The lights dimmed. Some of those black lights came on and a lady came out. The very first go-go dancer I have ever seen in my life came out. She was really interesting. She had a real interesting costume on. It had flames going all sorts of interesting places. And she moved, she took certain steps. I had a spiritual experience, you know, that kind of deal. Well, I watched her, and nothing else would have happened, but she walked over and sat down right beside me. And the guys, turned out she knew somebody at the table, and they began to give her a hard time, and she looked at me and she said, "Would you like to dance?" And I was ready. I said, "Yes." I didn't have any idea what kind of dance we were going to do, but I was going to be out there doing my best. And so we went out, we danced a little bit, and she said, "You know, I'm starved to death." And I said, "You know, I haven't had anything to eat since God knows when." And so I went back, and I got the president of the State Bar of Texas, and a senior lawyer in another law firm that represented a powerful and influential group in Dallas, and my go-go dancer, and I took us all to dinner at one of the nicest restaurants in Lubbock. Why they went, I will never know. But what I remembered that day out there was I began to remember what happened in that restaurant. That lady had what you would call a foul mouth and a loud mouth, and she told some of the raunchiest stories in a loud voice that I have ever heard in my life. And it suddenly occurred to me that, you know, those other two guys might have questioned my judgment in bringing her along on this evening. And then, in just a moment, I began to remember all of the other alcoholic things I had done in the presence of this man, like pulling in at Dairy Queen's and getting two cups of shaved ice and just happening to have a bottle of scotch under the front seat of my car and then filling his glass up with scotch and mine up and driving 80 miles an hour down the road. I did all kinds of things to demonstrate to him that he was in the presence of a real alcoholic. Now, if you're starting a new business, would you invite a real alcoholic to go with you? Of course you wouldn't. I wouldn't. And so suddenly I broke through blame to recognizing that I owed this guy an amend. Because not only had I misjudged him, but I had talked a fair amount to anyone who would listen to me about his lack of loyalty, about his poor judgment, and about how he couldn't really practice unless he had a good young lawyer working behind him. You know, all of this kind of stuff that I'd put out on the street didn't hurt him a hell of a lot because he went on to be president of the American Bar Association. But that didn't have anything to do with it. I had to look at myself and say, you know, I've misjudged this situation. The truth was obscured from me for a long time because I could not see myself as I really was. I couldn't allow myself to have made those kind of mistakes. And it took me a long, long time to see how I had harmed him. It took me a long, long time to appreciate that I owed him an amend. And so I had to go back and put him on that amends list and make an amend. It's very important that you look at all the relationship of your life and recognize who have I harmed in any way. And when you write their names down, then you must become willing to make an amend. And you can't, you know, I don't really think you can forgive anybody. But I think you can become willing to forgive. I think the forgiveness, the release, the thing that just turns you loose from those people is probably God-given. It's sort of like surrender or acceptance or one of those things that just kind of seems to happen one day. But you've got to do the spade work. You've got to do the footwork. You've got to look at it and understand what you've done and be willing to make amends to them. You've got to forgive yourself as another person you need to forgive. You've got to cut yourself some slack. And then you've cut yourself some slack and you've given God a little slack and your fellow man a little slack and you began to recognize what you've done wrong and how you've harmed other people. Then you begin to consider what is an amend. What's an amend? The eighth step of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous says that this is a very important step for at least three reasons. Number one, we need to see what we did wrong. Number two, that we need to figure out what amends to make. And number three, it says that no field of endeavor could yield more satisfying results to us. We're about to learn some things in life as we take this step that will put us in good stead the rest of our life because our relationships were terrible. We didn't have good relationships with others. And all of us, almost all of us anyway, I did, I should say, participated in creating those bad relationships. When I began to examine and ask myself those questions, was I selfish? Did I arouse jealousy, suspicion, fear, etc. in relationships? I did that on a regular basis. I did that to get what I wanted or needed out of that relationship. There's a lady that was going to come here tonight who has got a great story about the ninth step. Her name's Kay R. I heard Kay tell this one time, and I just loved to hear it. I thought about it tonight when they were telling me she might have been here. She was married to this guy, and she became unmarried, but she had a hell of a resentment against this guy. I mean a bad one. They had some kids together, and it was just one of those bad divorces. And she just gave him hell. She dragged him into court. She called him at all hours of the day and night. She wrote him letters. She did everything rotten she could do to him. She was punishing him every way she could. And finally, she got to the ninth step of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she asked her sponsor, "What should I do about him? About him?" And her sponsor said, "Well, what have you been doing to him?" And she laid out this litany of things that she had done to him. And the sponsor said, "I think what you ought to do for amend to him is leave him alone. Don't write him. Don't call. Don't have anybody do it for you. Leave him alone." And she did that. An amend is basically the reverse of what you were doing. First of all, stop doing that. Whatever it was that hurt the person, stop doing that. That'll help some. And then we have to do whatever we can to restore that situation. Saying "I'm sorry" may be a part of an amend, but that is not an amend. Saying "I'm sorry" may be a part of it, but that's not all of it. There's some very basic rules for making amends. There is no area in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in which you need a sponsor more than you need one at the time you start making your amends. We don't have the objectivity. We don't have the ability to see the situation as it really is. We're going to make mistakes if there's any way to make one because we're operating generally off of some sort of an emotional basis with this person. And we need somebody to talk to about these things. But there are certain basic rules that you and I have to employ. One of those rules is to be hard on yourself and easier on the other guy. Hard on myself, easy on the other guy. Sometimes that means doing things that you did not want to do. Giving up things that you did not want to give up. When I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had two
kiddos. One of them was just about a junior in high school, my son. He was a hell of a kid about that age. He was on the football team and the basketball team and the baseball team, was president of the student body. Everybody liked him. He was Mr. Success everywhere you went. And I got to living my life through him. Mine wasn't going so good, so I decided I'll just help him live his life. And I mean, when I say I was helping him, I was working at it. I went, didn't just go to football games, hell no. I went to football practice and watched him practice. And then I talked to the coaches and suggested how they might improve their system. Pretty insistent on some of my ideas. And then I took my kid home and I critiqued him all the way home on the mistakes he had made in practice that day. Then I went to the football games. Then I helped keep the officials in line. I mean, I got all over them like ugly on a wart. Don't make mistakes against Hillcrest High School because you're going to have to talk to that crazy drunk dad who hangs around after the game. That's what you're going to have to do. I think I am the only person that I've ever heard of who had a technical foul called on him as a fan. You can't do it. It's not in the rule book. I spent a lot of time looking, and the officials cannot call a technical foul on somebody for just calling him a son of a bitch from the stands. I did. He gave the free shot. And it was everywhere. It was all of his life that I was messed up in his life. One night I was sitting in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and the subject of kids and how you relate to kids came up. And somebody said something that, well, not to me, but that I heard, a safe statement, that you got to let your kids grow up and live their own life. And for some reason that night, I recognized that I was not letting my son lead his own life. I just wasn't. So I went home. I recognized that I owed him an amend. And I sat him down and I told him that I've been walking all over you in your life. And the reason I've been doing that is because I've been kind of trying to live my life through you. And my program at AA tells me that I need to make amends to people that I've been hurting. And I think this is an amend I need to make to you. Now I'm going to tell you what I'm going to do. I'm not going to any more football practices with you. I'm not going to discuss football, basketball, or baseball with the coaches. I am not going to bother any more officials, even if they're calling balls strikes and strikes balls. I'm just not going to do that anymore. I am going to go to some of your ball games because I care about you and support you. But that's the way it's going to be. Now, interesting thing, my son's reaction. My son felt rejection. He felt like, some reason or other, I wasn't going to care about what happened to him anymore. Now, this is really important. You see, when I go to make an amend, the way the other person reacts is none of my business. I don't think I said a thing to him that led him to believe that I was abandoning him or I was whatever. But that was his reaction. And I'm not doing this to please him. You don't make an amend to please the other person. You make an amend to clean up your side of the street. To do the thing that ought to have been done in the first place. To straighten it out. You don't do it to be popular. You don't do it to get on their good side. You don't do it to be forgiven. You do it because it's the right thing for you to do. And I told him that. And he felt rejected for a little while. And then he began to notice that he liked football and basketball and baseball and everything else a hell of a lot better without me being so intimately involved in that situation. And our good, healthy relationship started that day. It turned out to be a good enough relationship that when he was in medical school and had a really substantial problem a few years later, he came to me and said, how would Alcoholics Anonymous solve this problem? And I began to tell him what I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous. And he borrowed the book. And he started going to an adult child of alcoholics meeting. And he met a young alcoholic there who became his sponsor. And then he began to sneak into meetings, closed AA meetings. He was sneaking in them. And I explained the traditions to him that you don't sneak into closed AA meetings when you're just damned Al-Anon, you know. And he explained to me he liked to go to them. And I said, I don't give a damn whether you like to go to them or not. They're for alcoholics. That's why we have them. And damned if he didn't keep doing it off and on. Then one night, he came home and said, showed me a desire chip and said, Dad, joined Alcoholics Anonymous tonight. I said, what in the hell are you talking about? I almost told him I spilled more whiskey on my tie than you ever drank. But he had that figured out. He said, you probably have. You probably said, you've got a lot further than I ever went. But he said, I can see my, as I sat in those meetings and listened to people, I could identify what was going wrong. I could understand and identify totally with them up to a point. But I don't know why I need to go to jail. I don't know why I need to lose jobs. I don't know why I need to get kicked out of medical school. I don't know why I need to do all those other things, do you? And I said, no, I don't know why you need to do that. And so the program of Alcoholics Anonymous came to him at a time when he hadn't lost as much as some of us have. That came because I took an indirect action. I had a daughter. I didn't have time to fool with her because I was working on my son all the time. She was just a little old knobby-kneed girl, you know, and I didn't know what to do with little knobby-kneed girls. I still don't know what to do with them very much. They got out of playing dolls, and I never care much about playing dolls anyway, and they just sat around and whispered and giggled is all I could tell they were doing. And I could take them out and buy them things, but that's about all I could get done. And so I tried to get something going for my daughter after I got sober. I recognized there was a lack there. I hadn't been given her what she was entitled to receive. And I couldn't get nothing to happen. She wasn't buying any of my action at all. Finally, I asked my wife that night. I said, Billy, how can I get something going with Karen? She said, oh, Jerry, I don't know. You take her shopping? Yeah, I'm taking her shopping. She said, well, why don't you take her to dinner? I said, what? She said, take her to dinner. Go on a date with her. I walked in the other room and I said, Karen, you want to go out to dinner tomorrow night? She said, why? I said, because I want to be with you. And I want to get to know you. Who would go? Me and you. Where would we go? Anywhere you want to go. Okay. So we started. Went two or three times, next two or three weeks. We went once a week for about two or three weeks. Then I stopped because I needed some mutuality here. I needed for her to need that relationship just as much as I did. I didn't want to force myself on another kid. A couple of weeks passed and she hadn't said one damn word about going to dinner anymore. And I thought, well, I've blown that one. Then one night she walked in and she said, Daddy, aren't we going to go to dinner anymore? And I said, oh, you bet we are. You bet we are. We still are. We still are. I gave myself to her, and she gave herself to me. And that's been the basis of a good relationship. I took the right action. It took courage to do those things because, you see, I'm the father figure and I don't make mistakes. But I had to admit I was wrong, and I had to make amends to people when I'd wronged them. And we got to look at all of our lives, and you've got to make your decision about what the amend is. You know who you've wronged. You know who you've harmed if you'll be honest with yourself. And you'll have an idea about what you ought to do. And you ought to talk to your sponsor about it. But if you really need to do it, you know, you really got to do what you got to do. It says we should not ever take this step in any way that would harm another human being. We have no right to get well at anybody else's expense. So if you got an idea of confessing infidelity or anything like that, you better give it a long thought because you're about to create more harm than you're going to fix. You need to talk to your sponsor about those things. A few of us have violated some laws. Sometimes they put you in jail for that. And you may feel an overwhelming desire to go down to the district attorney's office and confess. Some people just can't figure a way to solve that problem any other way. One of the guys I worked with one time had stolen about $125,000 over a period of time. He made about $15,000 a year. It's going to take a hell of a long time to live and pay that back, I'll tell you for sure. He was married and had a couple of kids that relied upon him for support. It occurred to me as his sponsor that him going to jail doesn't help those kids a hell of a lot. It doesn't help his wife. And I asked him if he thought that was really the case. Who would he go give the money to? He didn't even know who to give it to. Some corporation. He had been skimming money. And I said, you know, there's a lot of guys in jail for doing that. A lot of guys are in jail right now that got caught. Why don't you start taking the program of Alcoholics Anonymous to the prison system and make your amend that way? Why don't you go help the people who are serving time for you? And he says that's worked. He says that he became free. You see, the secret is for me to get free of whatever I feel guilty about. Free. So I can walk around. There oughtn't to be any place in the world as an alcoholic that I can't walk in and sit down beside any person. They may get up and leave, but that's their problem. I need to clean my side of the street so that I can stand tall. I've scuffed around and scratched around in this life long enough, feeling bad about myself. I don't need to apologize for me anymore. I've made some mistakes, but that's okay. Lots of people made mistakes. But the good members of Alcoholics Anonymous are the people who, having made a mistake, have gone back and done their damnedest to straighten it up. And that's not too shabby. That's not anything to be ashamed of. You can't always make amends to everyone. Some people have died. Some people you can't find. Those telephone operators that I cussed out. The people that I ran off the road. The sales ladies that I chewed out for not having the right kind of policy in their stores. Things that they had absolutely no power over and I just gave them hell about. There's a lot of folks like that that I couldn't do a lot about. You need to make those amends as early as you can. When you don't let somebody die if you can avoid it. Go on and get through the steps and make your amends. But then even then there's going to be some people that you have trouble finding. Well, make them amends to somebody else. Make a contribution to life. Tell a salesperson, you're doing a good job. I really appreciate the way you served me today. Compliment the operator on her courtesy. Make a contribution the way it talks about in the third step. We took a lot out of life, and now we can put a lot back in. And it doesn't take much to make a good day for somebody. You've had it happen to you. Somebody just said, hey, that's good stuff. I appreciate what you're doing there. It makes you feel good. Give it back. Now, the book has got some promises at this point. You ought to go home and read those promises. Because those promises tell us when we're doing it right. Those promises come true for all of us. My opinion is when you experience those promises, when you will not regret the past or wish to close the door upon it, when all of those terrible things you did are suddenly converted into an asset, when you will know peace and when you will know serenity, you won't have economic insecurity. You'll see how you can be useful to your fellow man. When you're experiencing those kind of thoughts and those kind of feelings, I believe you are experiencing the power. That's what I think is the payday when you can say, is it working in my life? Have I made contact with the power? Is the power functioning in my life? That's my proof. That's all the proof I've ever had. And today, that's all I want. I'm happy to lead a comfortable, useful life, knowing who I am, knowing who you are, knowing we're dead even as far as being human beings, and knowing that there's a power that functions in both of our lives if we give it an opportunity. And if I've worked those steps to this point, it will truly work in my life, and I will experience those promises. It says, do these always work? Do these always happen? And it says, sometimes slowly, sometimes quickly. They always come to us if we work at it. And I can truthfully say I have had all of the promises at some time. Do I have them forever? No. Some days I have them and some days I don't. When I'm working my program, I got them. When I'm not working my program, I haven't got them. It's just like everything else in this program. It's one day at a time. It's 1 hour at a time. It's always here and now. That's where the power is. Here and now. And when He's working in our lives and we experience those feelings, you are experiencing power. God does for us what we cannot do for ourselves. That's when we know it. See you next week.
Isn't he great? Another hand for Jerry.